Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
Pennsylvania has a long tradition of manufacturing centers. They called them ironworks, places where people came together to build things. This podcast is about building and sustaining our democracy. We call it Democracy Works.
Hi, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam, and this is Democracy Works.
Chris, joining us today is perhaps Penn State's best-known scientist, certainly on social media, and boogeyman for many who do not accept the science of climate change, Michael Mann. Michael's a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and director of the Earth System Science Center. He's also one of five scientists then at Penn State to share the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore and 2,000 other scientists for their work on climate change.
So Michael is actually the first Nobel Prize winner to appear on the Democracy Works podcast.
Yes, he is. It's hopefully
very,
not the last.
Very impressive. Just so you know, just all those folks listening, just mark that down. This is the date that we had our first Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah. Here at PSU and elsewhere, we have significant expertise on the science of climate change. Yet our politics about the issue are still stuck in a partisan divide over whether this science is even correct in its most fundamental findings about whether the Earth is warming and whether this change is attributable to mankind's activities, rather than debates over what to do about it.
Right. So we're not here to talk about climate change per se. We're here to talk about kind of the way in which climate change implicates questions of democracy and how democracy functions. And in that regard, climate change is not, it seems to me, the only area in which our public debate undermines or ignores or vilifies expertise and for that matter, science, right?
Right. As Al Gore put it, they're an inconvenient truth
right.
for
mm-hmm.
many.
Mm-hmm.
Today's discussion actually has me thinking a bit about a book that came out last year called The Death of Expertise. This was written by Tom Nichols, who's a professor at the Naval War College. Chris, why is expertise important in a democracy?
Well, so, I mean, that's a really big question, but let's just stipulate that, right, it, with respect to votes, everybody is equal, right? It doesn't matter if you are a Nobel Prize winner or somebody who is way far away from that, your vote counts the same.
Right, but somehow we've gotten into this populist idea that not only is everybody's vote equal, but everybody's opinion is equal.
Right. Isaac Asimov has a famous quote that says, democracy does not mean that my ignorance, or that your ignorance equals my knowledge.
This is a longstanding sort of feature of American politics, American cultural life, precedes the election of Donald Trump.
Oh, well,
certainly.
Yes.
But there seems something different about it in this current environment, and I think it's because of how much Trump's populism included just explicit attacks at rallies and in different kinds of things on expertise, on the very notion of expertise. And then he admitted, you know, and then he made appointments to his cabinet and elsewhere of people that were clearly just not experts.
I mean, it absolutely feeds a narrative that that these people don't have your best interests at heart, that they serve an agenda that undermines your place in the world. And they're just the idea that they are somehow driven by a pursuit of the truth is just a lie. And it's a lie that harms you, the Trump voter.
Right. They're very often painted as partisans themselves,
right,
or as using information just to promote some sort of partisan or political cause. But, I mean, experts play a vital role in a democracy. Democracies, I mean, especially we have a Republican government, not a democracy. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before. So this is not government by mob rule.
Mm-hmm.
It's predicated on the notion of some kind of specialization where we are in effect hiring representatives to be making decisions for us, and we depend upon, or we expect that those representatives are using the best available information to make decisions.
Right. I mean, the world is an extremely complicated place, and it's impossible for any one person to understand, evaluate, and have a sufficient grasp of all the issues that are out there.
Right. So we depend upon our representatives to be better informed than we are,
right,
and to rely on those who know things.
On our politicians to rely on those who actually know something about what they're talking about.
Right. So why don't we bring in Jenna, and let's hear from Michael Mann.
Someone who actually knows what he's talking about.
There you go.
Michael Mann, thank you so much for joining us today on Democracy Works.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So as Chris and Michael mentioned in the introduction, you are part of the team that created the now infamous hockey stick graph 20 years ago, right? And so that showed a dramatic rise in global temperatures during the course of the 20th century and drew backlash from industry, from government, from the media, from internet trolls before internet trolls were even a thing, right? You write about all of this in your book called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, which came out in 2012. And I think maybe perhaps ended on a cautiously optimistic note, at least at that time, about where things were with regard to the climate change debate. I'm curious if you still have that sense of cautious optimism now as we sit in 2018.
So in the hockey stick and the climate wars, I do express cautious optimism in the epilogue of the book. And even today, when, you know, it might seem that we have reasons for pessimism here in the U.S. when it comes to climate action, we've got a president who is a climate change denier and has appointed to cabinet level positions fossil fuel lobbyists and climate change deniers and people from think tanks and front groups that have been funding the war on climate science for years. One might reasonably perceive that as a challenging atmosphere for actually seeing progress on this issue. And yet we are seeing progress at the state level, at the local level. Some of our largest businesses are acting on climate. When Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord or threatened to pull out of the Paris Accord more than a year ago, a number of states and cities, some of our largest cities, all weighed in with the "We Are Still In" pledge, that they're still dedicated to the Paris Accord, regardless of what Donald Trump does. Again, some of our largest businesses, many of our largest companies and corporations here in the U.S. And so there are folks who have actually tallied up sort of the effect of all of those commitments. And it turns out that even if Trump were to technically pull out of the Paris Accord, we would still likely meet our obligations under Paris, just based on all that progress that's taking place at the local level, at the state level, states banding together to form regional coalitions for pricing carbon, for incentivizing renewable energy. So again, that's reason for cautious optimism. Now, just meeting the Paris obligations isn't enough to keep warming below truly dangerous levels. To do that, we will need to improve significantly. We'll need to ratchet up the commitments that the various countries of the world made in the Paris Agreement. A few years down the road, when we have the next major conference of the parties, we'll need to ratchet up those commitments. But we can at least now see a path forward. We are now starting to see that curve bend downward toward where we stabilize and then ultimately bring down our carbon emissions as we transition.
You touched on two things that we've talked about on this podcast previously. One, most recently, the role of corporations in a democracy and companies kind of stepping up to the plate in a time when government seems to be so gridlocked that, you know, companies are kind of maybe stepping up to fill that void. And the other, of course, is the idea of dissent and of protests and people really truly feeling empowered to, you know, find their voices in a democracy to take a stand on any number of issues, climate change, of course, being one of them.
Yeah, well, let me follow up on that latter point, because indeed that is perhaps one of the primary reasons for optimism. The fact that in the age of Trump, when so many of our institutions seem under attack by, you know, our executive branch, by our president, when as we heard earlier in the discussion, there is this war on fact-based discourse. So in that, what might seem, again, an oppressive atmosphere for change and for action, we have seen this sort of reawakening. Of course, there were all these marches, the Washington, D.C. Science March more than a year ago. I was actually at the front of that march with my good friend Bill Nye, and he was out there making the case that we have to defend science. We can't stand on the sidelines.
Sure.
Much as scientists, you know, have felt at times that, well, you know, our job is just to put the information out there, to publish the articles, and then we'll just let politicians and society deal with that. We'll let them figure it out. And that doesn't work.
So to that point of scientists having to be out there, being advocates for facts, that's a journey that you had to make personally, right? You talk about that in your book some. What was that process like for you, going from somebody, you know, working in a lab by yourself to somebody who's out all over the world speaking about these issues?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I would have been happy to have been left alone in the lab doing what I love doing, which was science, solving problems. And when I double majored in applied math and physics at UC Berkeley and went on to study theoretical physics at Yale and ultimately ended up in the field of climate science, the last thing on my agenda, the last thing on my mind was the idea that I would find myself at the very center of one of the most fractious societal debates we've ever had, the debate over human-caused climate change. It's not what I signed up for. It's not what I thought I was getting into. But because when we published the hockey stick graph, whether I liked it or not, I was now sort of forced out into the public sphere, in part by the attacks against me, which were aimed at discrediting me and thereby discrediting this iconic graph, which had become sort of a rallying call for the case for climate action. So it's an uncomfortable place to be as a scientist. You're not trained as a scientist to work in that realm. You're trained to operate within the world of science, where facts and logic rule the day, and where there is a very carefully vetted process, the peer review process for litigating science. And there's a formal process that's in place, and it has served us well. It's what the great Carl Sagan called the self-correcting machinery of science. But when you leave that sphere and you're forced out into the public sphere, the rules of engagement are entirely different. And you have people who are not engaged in good faith debate, but are trying to discredit you by misrepresenting the facts, by using rhetoric over logic. They're not trying to win the scientific case. They're trying to win in the court of public opinion. And as a scientist, if you're going to defend yourself in that environment, you need to learn a whole new set of tools. You need to develop a whole new knowledge base for how you communicate information to the public in what is not a neutral atmosphere but an adverse atmosphere where special interests are doing everything they can to game the discussion and to discredit you and kill you as the messenger. Over time, you know, I've become comfortable in that space, and I've come to embrace that role because in the end, as I've often said, what more noble pursuit could I be engaged in as a scientist than this pursuit to inform what may be, inform the public conversation about what may be the greatest threat we face as a civilization, right. The threat of climate change.
Right. You also talk in your book about something called the Serengeti strategy. Can you tell us what that is, how it was used against you, and then how you kind of turn the tables to use it against people who don't share your views?
Yeah, I coined that term because in the prologue of the hockey stick in the climate wars. Back in 1999, when I was still a young scientist, a postdoc, I was participating in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And we had a meeting in Arusha, Tanzania. And we went out to see the Serengeti. We had a sort of field trip where we got out into the Serengeti and we got to see, the magnificent, fauna, the lions and the zebras and the giraffes. And one of the things that was very interesting to me, you would see the zebras all sort of standing back to back and forming an almost perfect wall of stripes. And I remember somebody asked our host, why do they do that? And he explained, this is because, when the predators just see this continuous wall of stripes, there's nothing to attack. There's nobody to go after. There's nobody to single out. So it's those stray zebras at the edge of the herd or who wander away who are the vulnerable ones. And so that was a very sort of formative experience seeing that and then sort of parlaying it into an analogy for how the critics of, climate change science go after individuals. They know they can't take down the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They know they can't take down the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. They know they can't take down all of the major scientific societies in the U.S., all of whom are on record, by the way, that climate change is real, human-caused, and a problem. They know that they can't take down the entire scientific community. So they look for what they perceive to be one vulnerable member of that community, a postdoc, for example, who doesn't have a permanent job yet, who just published a controversial study, and to make an example of them, to use the full weight of the power and influence of the fossil fuel interests who fund them, fund these organizations and front groups to bring down this one person in the hope that it will set an example for any others who might stray off and become prominent in terms of the science that they're publishing, might contribute in a prominent way to conveying the threat of climate change in the work that they're publishing or just in the outreach that they're doing.
Yeah. And so at any point when those attacks were happening, did you ever begin to question what you were doing? Like, maybe this isn't right or maybe I'm not as confident as I should be in this data, this research.
Yeah, no, I was pretty confident in our science. I'm confident in the scientific process, for one thing. And the fact is, if it were just our study, that would be one thing. But now, 20 years later, there are dozens of other studies by different groups using different data, different methods, and all come not only to the same conclusion, the conclusion now stronger. The scientific community now has reason to believe that the warming spike that we've seen over the past century may well be unprecedented in tens of thousands of years.
And is there a sense within kind of the scientific community that while you may quibble internally about how things should be done, or, you know, this method versus that, or these types of things, that you all have to kind of present a united front to the public in order to really kind of get your message out there and take on all these people who are trying to discredit and dismantle what you're doing?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that there is a very robust debate within the scientific community. What we spend our time doing is debating the unknowns, the things that, you know, we don't know, because just rehashing or relitigating what's already known and what's been validated over and over and over isn't interesting. So scientists spend most of their time arguing, again, because we're sort of at the forefront of the of our knowledge. That's where we spend our time. Research aimed at literally extending the forefront, the boundary between what's known and what isn't known. And there is always robust scientific debate within the, you know, in the peer-reviewed literature. You have an article that's published, and then somebody will publish a comment, and there'll be a reply. At meetings, scientists will present work, and then other scientists in the audience will question them, sometimes very aggressively. The way you get grants is by showing that there's something that we don't understand and that there's something that needs to be researched. It's by disagreeing, saying, I think the conventional wisdom is wrong here, and I've got an alternative hypothesis I'd like to explore. That sort of science gets funded. Science that says, okay, I'm just going to rehash what's already known. You think the National Science Foundation wants to fund that? You think NASA wants to fund that? Of course not. So what the critics have often tried to do, you know, it's sort of what I call projection, where they will sort of take their own views, because they are driven by agenda. They're not driven by an honest interest in discovery, in scientific discovery, in scientific inquiry. And they'll project that onto the scientists as if we're somehow in it for the money and we're agreeing with each other. It's just the opposite. And that's really important, because what it means is that when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, when the National Academy of Sciences says it is very likely or extremely likely that the following is true, that we are responsible for most or all of the warming, when those institutions say that, that is the lowest common denominator. That conclusion is the conclusion that they've been able to get a diverse group of scientists with different views to agree upon. And so when the National Academy of Sciences or the IPCC weighs in and says, you know, we are virtually certain that humans are causing the warming of the planet that we've seen, we should, you know, we should be aware that that scientific institutions, organizations don't like to use such strong language. They prefer to hedge. The world of science is intrinsically sort of reticent. And so when an organization like the IPCC or the U.S. National Academy of Sciences comes out with a statement as affirmative as the statements we've seen on climate change, you better believe that you know, the scientific community has reached a consensus on this matter.
Right. Do you have thoughts on what Chris and Michael were talking about in their introduction, kind of how to square this notion that in a democracy, everyone's vote is equal, but everyone's opinion is not, and the role that experts should play in all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. There is this attack on expertise, on fact-based discourse underway today. You know, alternative facts, of course, the notion of alternative facts and fake news, which are widespread in our public discourse today. Well, in the world of climate science and climate change denial, we were dealing with those problems years ago. We sort of saw it coming. And in fact, some of the strategies that we've seen deployed by the forces of climate change denial, the forces seeking to corrupt our democracy and to advance, a corporate agenda. All of the tools, all of the approaches that we are seeing deployed today, we saw years ago. Let's take the issue of stolen emails posted by WikiLeaks, Russia hacking email server, using it to discredit somebody or some group going into a very important political event. Now, you could think I was talking about the last presidential election.
No, I'm talking about yourself.
I'm talking about the so-called ClimateGate affair of December 2009. Same actors, same modus operandi. What has happened, in my view, is this this cancer that we saw afflict the discourse over human-caused climate change has now metastasized to infect our entire body politic. And there's some disturbing parallels here as well. There was some discussion of Brexit earlier. Brexit, Russiagate, Climategate, what they all had in common was actually an interest on the part of Russia working together with multinational fossil fuel corporations like ExxonMobil. So Climategate, you know, is fairly straightforward. The goal was to sabotage the upcoming Copenhagen summit, which was the sort of first major opportunity in years for a concerted global action on climate change. And Russia has a stake in developing their fossil fuel reserves. And now we sort of understand that their involvement was probably more important than we had realized on the time. And the agenda was pretty clear to sort of sabotage this climate summit to prevent action being taken to curtail the burning and exploitation of fossil fuels.
Going back to the cancer metaphor that you started with a couple of minutes ago, what is the treatment for some of these problems we're facing now? Is there anything that some of these larger debates can learn from the, you know, Climategate and all of the struggles you and your colleagues have gone through over the past 20 years?
Yeah, I would say, you know, ultimately the only real solution is democracy and the democratic process and people getting out and voting. Because as long as we have low turnout and as long as we allow special interests to prevail in these elections by spending massive amounts of dark money to get their favored candidates elected, as long as we allow that to happen, we know where that leads us. That leads us down sort of the path that we're on right now with a climate change denying president advancing a fossil fuel agenda, appointing to head up his EPA, Scott Pruitt, who is essentially an agent for the Koch brothers, who is literally in the process of dismantling a half century of environmental protections over the course of 1 year. And the only cure for that is getting out and voting. And there is, you know, a major opportunity in this next midterm election. If people turn out, there's the potential for sending a strong message that we want to go in a different direction and for actually changing the leadership in one or both houses of Congress so that there will actually be a check on what the administration is doing and there will be an opportunity to actually move forward. Again, the reason for cautious optimism is even in the oppressive environment we're in right now, where that isn't the case, we're seeing so much progress at the local level, at the state level, even by many companies, that if we can then sort of return our Congress to sort of return Congress to to a state where it's it can actually become part of the solution rather than part of the problem, then we can really hit the ground running.
Can you share an example of a time when you saw someone's point of view change as a result of talking with you or one of your colleagues or, you know, one of the deniers kind of come around?
Yeah, there have been some great examples. There was somebody who used to work for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a Koch brothers front group basically exists to discredit any science that threatens vested interests like the fossil fuel industry. And he sort of went, experienced this catharsis and realized that he had been, you know, fighting on the side of evil. He's still a Republican, but he's trying to make the case that, hey, let's be on the right side of the science. Let's engage in the worthy debate over what we do about this problem. But let's not be stuck in this unworthy debate about whether the problem exists. I have had individuals who were self-avowed contrarians or skeptics. Of course, skeptic in my book is a good thing. All scientists are skeptics. One-sided skepticism, where you reject overwhelming evidence in face of conspiracy theories and patently flawed reasoning, that's not real skepticism. That's denial, that's contrarianism, and yet too often we allow people in that group to brandish themselves as skeptics. They're not skeptics. But I've had contrarians who came up to me and said, you know, before I came in here, after I gave a public lecture, for example, I really didn't, you know, believe the science, but more often it's not you've convinced me, it's you've got me thinking now. And really that's all we can hope for. That's what we want them to do. We don't want to replace one evangelism with another evangelism. We want critical think. We want them to be able to critically evaluate the evidence. And we have to help them to do that. And we have to educate, you know, students to do that, because, you know, it's the old adage, you give a man or a woman a fish, you feed them for a day. You teach them to fish, you feed them for a life. It's the same thing with critical reasoning. If you provide them the tools for doing that, then the next time they hear some talking head trying to convince them that climate change is a hoax, they have resources to draw upon. Say, well, wait, no, you know, if I go to, you know, the National Academy of Science report, or I go to this website, you know, sponsored by the National Science Foundation or the National Academy of Sciences, what you're saying is not true. The scientists, give them those tools, give them those resources.
Yeah, that's great. And I think we can all draw lessons from that for sure. So we're going to close now with our Mood of the Nation poll questions. This will be a lightning round. So four questions, all thinking specifically about American politics. So we'll start off. What makes you angry?
What makes me angry is that there's overwhelming scientific evidence for the reality and threat of climate change, and we're still debating this in our Congress.
And then what makes you proud?
What makes me proud are the children, are the kids today who are speaking out and who are trying to reclaim their democracy.
And what makes you worry?
What makes me worry is that we will act on this problem, but it won't be soon enough, and we will consign millions of people to suffering that was unnecessary.
And then finally, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope, once again, are the youth of this country. And I'll tell you, kids are not in a position to directly impact policy, but they are in a position to directly impact the adults in their life. And there is such a huge opportunity for us to learn from our children empathically and that's really why it is so important to engage our children. This is a problem that they are likely to inherit the worst aspects of if we don't act now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we will leave it there. Dr. Mann, thank you so much for joining us today on Democracy Works.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, so we're back. I don't know whether we should be angry or depressed or both, or where do you come down, Michael?
Well, you know me. So
we both officially transitioned into curmudgeonness. So
never particularly optimistic. I do appreciate some of Michael's optimism on where this particular debate is going. I think he's right that certainly in the corporate world we've seen for quite a while now quite a bit of progress on work on climate change, certainly at the state and local level we're seeing it, certainly in other places around the world. Even within the federal government, you know, the Defense Department has made it very clear that they see climate change as one of the most pressing issues. There are technological advances that can be made, and government can play a role in all of this. But first, we'd have to get past the basic discussion about whether or not climate change exists.
Right. And, you know, and as he was talking, the thing that flashed in my mind was, and I'm sure you'll remember this, but it was a long time ago when Henry Waxman in Congress asked every tobacco executive on the record, do you believe that nicotine is addictive? And every single one of them said no. And every single one of them lied.
Yeah, every one of them lied.
Every one of them lied.
Well, sure, they had the science on this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And let's not be coy about this. This was about their own self-interest with respect to their own profit motives.
Right. Well,
and that really kind of accounts for what is behind every effort to undermine this debate.
Right. We've seen this before.
Right. It's very much the same modus operandi. It's very much the same objectives.
The stakes may be larger.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure. Yeah. But it is because they see this as a threat to their bottom line. And you know, I'm not saying that everybody associated with this is a liar, because self-interest has a profound effect on people's perspective and on the biases that we all bring to every conversation. But, you know, that is why science is such an incredibly essential tool.
Right. You know, we've talked a lot on the show so far this year about the war on the media.
Mm-hmm.
And so Michael today brought up the war on science. You know, when I think about these are sort of two different epistemological approaches to knowing what's going on
right.
in the
epistemology
world.
Is how you know what you know. What
right.
can we know?
I wanted to get
it?
The word epistemological
yeah, very impressive.
Into the
yeah.
podcast.
Yeah.
yeah. And so they're both two different ways of knowing, of understanding what it is that's happening out there, that what the material world is all about. And both have their flaws.
Of course, human enterprises, right?
And journalism is the first cut,
mm-hmm.
And journalists make mistakes, and interpretations are going to change as more facts become known. But the fact that they're sometimes wrong doesn't mean that it's not that the media is not playing a very important role in bringing to the public debate, as mm-hmm. is required mm-hmm. in a democracy, facts. Of course, science is another method, a more established method for understanding what's going on in the world. But as Michael, I think, really well pointed out, it's probabilistic.
Mm-hmm.
But we have two different ways that are very important in a democracy to understanding what's going on, to bringing facts into the public debate. And both in this current political era, it's been going on for a while, but it seems to all be on kind of hyperspeed these days, are under attack. And this war on the media, the war on science, these are wars on understanding.
Right, on the idea, the concept.
The concept of expertise, the concept of fact.
How do we have what I thought, you know, his Michael Mann's phrase, a worthy debate versus an unworthy debate. It's not that we don't, I mean, because politics is another mechanism by which we seek to find the truth.
Well,
through
to find
honest
solutions
debate.
In
right,
a way.
Exactly.
Yes.
Just to argue and to through this argument and through this debate and the expression of different views, come to a better understanding of what the reality is. But all politics, too, requires at some level what, you know, man referred to again and again as a good faith argument. And I understand it's politics. I understand that there's minimal. There's, you know, you can only expect so much here. But if we are not respectful of the values and the mores that undergird politics, journalism, and science, we are in bigger trouble than we think we are.
Right. I like this notion of this creeping partisanization of everything, and you know certainly we've seen that in our Mood of the Nation poll and various reports that we've put out, and it's. Lots of commentators on American politics are talking about this these days. Everything just seems to have
mm-hmm.
developed a kind of partisan split to it. And of course, one's own partisanship makes it very difficult for them to take in information that contradicts
for all of us.
Yes, for all of us.
Right. And that is just human nature. But what I'm hearing from Michael Mann is just all that makes it all the more essential. That we work to maintain and to build up, reinvigorate these mores that are essential for us to try to overcome these biases that all of us have.
Yeah, well, that sounds like some of the hard work of democracy.
And that's what Michael Mann reflects in his own personhood,
yeah.
just someone who is living up to the standards of science.
Yeah,
and our democracy is better for it.
This has been Democracy Works, a production of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State.
I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Michael Berkman.
Thank you for listening.